Welcome to Cattle HQ, a podcast from industry experts and progressive producers discussing cutting-edge info about the cow-calf sector to keep cattlemen and women in the know and positively affect their bottom line.
Welcome to Cattle HQ, brought to you by South Dakota State University Extension. I'm Taylor Grusing, cow-calf field specialist at the Mitchell Regional Extension Office. And today I'm joined by my coworker, Pete Bauman, who's up in the Watertown office. And we're going to talk about maybe moving or transitioning some calving seasons. And if you have mud right now, hopefully that's a good thing because we're looking for moisture still, I think, to get our grass to grow. But mud during calving season isn't always fun, especially if you're calving in March or April. And so some of the times we hear producers say, you know, I really want to calve on grass, right? Or I want to move to spring calving. And so that might be May for some people, might be June for others, but essentially trying to move it 2 months or so, so we can avoid that mud. But I think there's a lot of questions that go into that more than just turning the bull out later. And so I had these questions when I was visiting with Pete one day. And so he's going to hopefully help us navigate that. And we're going to walk through it together of some things we need to think about if we're going to go change that calving date. So welcome to the podcast, Pete.
All right. Thank you, Taylor. Thanks for having me.
You should probably give yourself a better introduction of all the people you work with. He is a very experienced person in extension and a person I look up to in terms of how he works with producers and how they call him. So give us a feedback of how you started, how you got here, and what's your favorite part of extension?
All right. Well, thanks, Taylor. I guess I want to start off with, I kind of bristle at the concept of being labeled an expert in anything. And I kind of have this standing rule that if anybody calls themselves an expert, you should probably just walk away because they're probably not. I think everybody just brings a suite of experiences, but I'm certainly not an expert in calving, breeding, or even what we're going to talk about today. But I kind of label myself more like the gateway drug for landowners, right? Like I'm the easy thing for people to approach because we're not selling anything. We're just trying to talk truth and kind of help people drill down to goals and objectives. And really, I really prescribe to the kind of a holistic framework for thinking. So that's kind of what I bring to the table. How I got started is I grew up on a small family beef operation in Minnesota. Okay. And we did just pretty typical stuff from back, you know, back growing up in the 80s and 90s and in small, you know, our cows were bred in more or less dry lot and pasture scenario. Everything was fed and we built a calving barn when my dad could afford it. And we calved inside in February and March. And all I have is bad memories. More or less. No, that's not true. I have a lot of great memories when things worked out, but it's the bad ones that really stick with you, right?
Right.
I don't know that there was a lesson in that or not, but and throughout my career, then I've worked in rangeland management and grassland management, etc. And as I've come to SDSU Extension, I'm assigned to the South Dakota Grassland Coalition, and the coalition is really made up a lot of progressive grass-oriented producers. And one of the themes that runs throughout kind of that mindset, you might say, that type of producer is really the idea of reducing input costs.
Right.
And so when we talk about later calving, it's kind of based on a lot of different things that converge into a kind of what you might call a common sense approach. It doesn't mean that it's easy, but it is somewhat common sense. And that if we want to reduce labor, reduce input, make the cow work more for the producer versus the other way around, open up free time, family life, and as well, really matching our goals and objectives to the resources and to nature, all of those points converge at a later spring calving operation. Now, that's not to say that that's good or bad, better or worse. Not trying to put those caveats on it. It's just a different philosophy that might actually pay off in the long run. And we'll get into that obviously throughout, the more detailed points of that, right? But that's kind of the background. You asked what my favorite part of extension is. I would spend all day, every day on the farm and ranch with others, helping break down their operations and help them try to identify key points to future success if I could. I'd trade my desk in a heartbeat for that, but we all know
Your
we got
desk would be
desks.
your pickup truck
There's
permanently,
always
right?
desk work. And
Well, you
so.
brought up a good point of, the Grassland Coalition, and like you, it's kind of the mindset or, holistic thinking a little bit. And like you said, it's not good or bad, but it might change the labor things. A lot of times we go into calving season trying to bulk up that labor, right? So whether it's, hiring an extra person or, trying to make up that labor. And you think a lot on the eastern side of the Dakotas, we have farming happening in May. So how would we calve and farm in May? Like, so that just that kind of thought. But I think we got to get past that point and talk about these other things, like you said, of working with nature, and it decreases certain labor characteristics, or labor needs, I guess, and then it just changes where you focus that labor, I think.
So you're not wrong at all. But I think what we should do, instead of glossing over the farming versus ranching, let's take that one head on first. All right. That is the biggest tripwire for those that try to do both farm and ranch. But it's such a interesting paradigm that I'm too busy, so I need to calve early, calve my heifers in February, my cows in March, or something like that, so I can go farming in May. And it's a paradigm that everyone's personal experience would lend to. There's some truth to that. Except for that, the reality is, when you do allow the cows to work for you and calve on pasture in May, to a person, everyone says their labor goes away because the cows are doing the work. So you do go farming, and the first year or two, you keep leaving farming to go check on cows that don't need to be checked on, because you go check on them and you're like, hey, they're fine. And like, to a person, everybody conveys this exact same. They've got to go through. I think they've got to go through this. You can hear someone else do it, yes, but you've got to build that trust within your own relationship with your own within your own mind, that actually I can trust my cows to take care of this. And the key, I think, from listening and interviewing and talking to so many producers that do this, the key is that we are working so much closer with the biology of the animal. And you're a nutritionist, so I'd love to hear your thoughts on this part of it. But when what do we know about successful calving? We know that there's certain nutritional requirements that a cow's got in her third trimester. We know that exercise is important to condition that cow for calving, right? When individuals move to a later calving date, they hit these things just by happenstance. That cow is on, let's say she's on grass maybe mid-April, early May, and she's calving sometime in May, something like that. Well, you're hitting that third trimester right at the highest nutritional quality of those early season forages. So that's a
Right.
boost. And people describe these calves as being more greasy than other calves. I don't know, let's call it what it is.
Okay.
But the other thing is, she's out there maybe getting exercise for 2 to 3 to 4 weeks ahead of time, walking around, foraging, conditioning that body. And we tend to see, like, go, oh wow, that's really cool. That makes sense. But guess what? Mother Nature's been doing it with wildlife forever. Elk,
Right.
bison, deer, antelope, when do they all drop their babies? June 1, more or less, late May, early June. And so all we're really doing is relearning what is kind of the natural cycle of things anyway. So I just wanted to kind of make that point, that if you make the other decisions, the correct decisions ahead of time, you can trust the cow to do her job in this arena.
I'm kind of on the nutrition side. We spend a lot of time up here putting up stored forages. So whether that's in round bales, square bales, whatever, so we can feed them during that cold period when our grasses aren't growing, because we think we need that extra nutrition, especially if we are hitting that third trimester in January, February to cabin March, let's say. So yeah, we need that extra nutrition rolled up essentially so we can deliver it to them. But if we backed that up, we could let that cow hit mid gestation in December, January. She'd be just fine on those corn stalks, some of that dormant forage. She's gonna be able to thrive with that. And then we're gonna have to spend way less time rolling up hay in June and July also. So that kind of goes
Absolutely.
back to that family health, family or business side of things, that it's going to change more than just your calving labor. And we talked about this at a meeting this winter as well, of how much do you spend on that new hay cutter if you don't put up as much hay? So again, I know it's not going to work for everybody, but when you start putting the pieces together, that she's going to be taking that bite of April green grass in late gestation, that's dang near what she needs. Maybe a little dry matter still, right? She's going to need a little bit of extra energy to go with that in a dry matter form, but she's carrying that calf onto green grass
Right.
inside of her, and it's going to lay down and have a nice calf, hopefully.
And there's so many rabbit holes we could go down here, but I want to touch on a couple things that first of all, I'm going to come back to the management of the calving pasture itself, pastures. But if you back up to what you said about reduced input costs, feeding costs during that really critical period, you're right. You're kind of parlaying her really critical period to the point where the weather and everything is more conducive to her maximizing those inputs. You're not having to make all those inputs and meet that in the coldest part of the year. So then it really, the other part of this is it really works well for those that are trying to graze longer or throughout the winter or not feed, whether they're bale grazing or whether they're aftermath grazing on crops, depending on what part of the state you're in, that sometimes that works better than others. But for the most part, those that have chosen to go to a later calving, it isn't done in a bubble as just the only change on the ranch or the farm. It usually is in conjunction with other management decisions that all are coordinated to make everything easier. For instance, less feeding, less labor throughout the midwinter. Maybe the cows are on bale grazing, or not all of those check boxes have to happen every time, but it's kind of a thought process. Like if I'm going to go to May grazing, May calving, for instance, what else can I simplify on the place? Sometimes it's forced. Sometimes it's an interesting thing that people stumble into this less labor thing because they're forced to, because they just don't have the labor. So it's almost like it's not necessarily always a decision on what they think is just the better management, but because they're forced to, they have to accept it as a management decision. And then they realize, oh my gosh, that was the best decision I ever made. Things, epiphanies like that. On the backside of it, though, I really want to touch on one thing. You mentioned dry matter on grass. And this goes a little deeper into our paradigms of what calving on grass might look like. I'm guessing our listeners right now are envisioning black shiny mama cows on 4-inch high lush green grass that's just a sea of green. It's really not the actual model that's best. These calving pastures are often managed in such a way that when those cows are turned out on those pat on those early spring pastures, there's a tremendous amount of standing dry matter grass from the previous year, so that cow not only can balance their diet, but that calf is actually dropped into quite a good bed of old grass versus new grass, whether that's native tall grass or some other derivative. But I think what we have to help the listener envision here is this isn't dropping calves onto a green golf course. You know, this is dropping calves into managed, planned pastures that were, you know, oftentimes rested a good portion of the previous year. Some people use this exact same pasture year after year after year. And with that repetition, they end up actually getting quite a bit of native tall grass, like big blue stems, structural grasses growing. That works, you know. I think you got to meet people where they're at. You know, there is still a somewhat of a caveat as you get into this that the desire to keep those cows a little closer to home, home or, you know, closer pastures. But but those that have just learned to trust the cow and trust their instinct, they have no problem calving a few miles, maybe sometimes many miles away from home. Let the cows do it, you know.
So let's get into that. On the grass management side, if you were setting up a new calving pasture to calve in May, what type of plant communities would you look at putting down, and how would you start managing that?
Let's talk about structural stuff first. I think, you know, sometimes it's probably just getting into it. You might feel more comfortable if you've got, say, less standing water, less flowing creeks, good drainage. You know, some of the same old caveats still apply, you know, to some degree. Not necessarily always as critical, but you know, there can be bad weather in May too. So protection and when I say structural, I mean, you know, taller grasses and things and managing for that, but also ensuring that you're not necessarily inviting a problem where you don't need to. You know, a pasture might be better to get started in as you kind of learn the process. Accessibility, ease of checking, you know, just some of those creature comforts for both the manager and the cow at first. As far as the plant community though, you kind of gotta accept what you've got, you know, to start with. We can talk about trying to change a plant community. So, I think the first set of caveats is most important first is that you've got it, that you pick a pasture that you know you can live with and get and just feel comfortable in. As far as what that plant community looks like, if it is a historic, overgrazed pasture, a lot of times they are, you know, kind of overutilized as they're close to home over generations. Oftentimes those are going to be our cool season exotic grass dominated type pastures like bromes and bluegrasses or quack grasses. That isn't a bad choice. Like you said, you may have to supplemental feed on that a little bit just for dry matter or some other balance that you're trying to achieve. You know, I'm not going to try to go too far down the nutritional road here, but you got to meet that cow's needs. Let's leave it at that. You know, access to water, of course, and you know, those are the things. But as far as an ideal plant community, I would love to see, if given the choice, native pasture. If you're in the Northeast, sometimes there's a lower shrub component, things like buckbrush that can offer a little bit of, you know, not only cold protection, but it can get really hot in May too, right? So there is no, you know, silver bullet here. It's just trying to hit the middle as best you can with what these animals are really conditioned to do, you know. So it can get hot in May, so you know, shade isn't a bad idea to have to consider. A lot of times, a big tuft of grass will actually offer quite a little micro climate of shade, you know. So we want to see structure in the grass. We want to see diverse grass, you know, a mix of cool season and hopefully some warm season grasses. Now, the warm season grasses aren't going to be all that palatable or nutritious at that time, but they do offer the protection and the structure and some of that dry matter balance, you might say. If I was going to take a crop field and go into the concept of a calving pasture, I would look at a good mix of native cool season and warm season grasses as a point of managing that. There's, I mean, and then there's caveats across the board on this, Taylor, right? Like, Is it a calving pasture that all you want to do is drop calves into and then get that pair to a week old and move off to yet a different pasture? Or do you want to keep them there for a month? You know, those are all questions that folks wrestle with. Cow management, pair management can, you know, if you've got taller structural grass, pair management can be an issue. If you're going to move to the next pasture, are you sure you're bringing all them calves with you? You know,
Right. They like to hide in
they
May
like to
too.
hide, and cows hide themselves. And
On purpose, yes.
so a lot of, you know, so these are somewhat easy solutions. And if you're only going one pasture away, the open gate method really works pretty well. Mama's going to want to be out there on that fresh, on the fresher grass, and she'll go back and get baby. And eventually, you know, you can you can close a gate or back fence behind them if necessary. But you
Sure.
know, a lot of people are trying to, I think, work smarter, not harder. And so instead of going and trying to find those babies and trying to push them somewhere that, you know, they don't know, let mom do the work and give her a few days to get to transition, you know, as you move between calving pastures or paddocks, you might say.
So with that, is it a good idea to have similar grasses in those pastures? Like, so they want to move to greener grass, or should you set them up to stagger a little bit? I mean, you're only talking probably 30 days either way, but is that
Well,
something you want to look at doing?
I think there's the ideal and then there's the reality of it. Like, we don't often have very good control over the species in our pastures. Let's just fit, you know, that's just kind of a common reality. Like, transitioning a plant community can be really difficult and take time. And that's why I don't want to go too far into saying, oh, the ideal pasture has to be this mix of species, because I wouldn't want to, influence someone not to try this just because of the species composition of the pasture. Species composition and nutrition can always be managed. It's the reduced input costs overall and letting the cow do the work that really, really is your is the impetus for considering this. So, but I would say too that as you do this kind of transition and management, you learn more about your pasture communities, and you may find that pasture C is actually a better calving pasture over time. You might not know that when you first start out, but that it might have a better diversity of early season broadleaf plants and forbs, native legumes that these cows really can mix their diet on. But I wouldn't want to discourage someone from trying just because they don't have a super diverse plant community. And oftentimes when you get into this kind of management, you by happenstance are moving, and you actually create an opportunity for the plant communities to respond positively. So you may find that you've got a lot more plants out there that respond to this type of management versus season-long continuous grazing that you might have practiced prior to. And they never get a chance to express themselves. So I hope that's, I know that's a little vague, but it's like there's so many different plant communities and scenarios out there. I think the first biggest hurdle is identifying your very best pasture that you can start the process in and feel comfortable with your ability to check on them and just get yourself, you know, more aware. You know,
To
we
kind of circle
haven't.
the wagon back, like you said, it's
Yeah.
not dropping calves on, golf courses, right? Like, so
Right.
it's looking for a new pasture. If you were gonna do this, year one, something you can rest, let's say, for almost a year, May to May calving. And so it's gonna have some dormant grasses there. It's gonna have that regrowth. You're gonna be looking for something to start out with.
Right. Yeah, you know, the one of the common terms that a lot of people use is stockpile
There you go.
grass. Like,
Stockpile grass. Yep.
so if you
Take
think
it to
about,
this year and
yeah,
then
if you think
calculate
about that
next year.
philosophy, that's kind of what you want to have ready in the spring is stockpiled grass, right? Of some. Now, again, there's a lot of opportunity and caveats for nuances within that, but if you kind of have that mindset, I want to have structural stockpile grass, that kind of leads you right down the right road of because once you start to, get your visual paradigm adjusted as to what you think you're looking for, then you can start looking deeper into the plant community. But at first, it's just like structure and function, access, comfort level. You know, year one, right? Like you don't have to try to do it all. You know, just get
Start
yourself
somewhere.
comfortable. Maybe
You
just
probably
start
have,
outside. You know, just start
yes.
outside. That might be the, you know, we had that in our calf, in your calf camp, right?
Right.
How many
Yep.
people? How many people did we talk to that said they're calving in May outside? And then I asked, well, how many are calving on pasture? And I think there was only one, but they were calving outside in May. So it's like, I don't know if you're not ready to. I know some folks that just bite the bullet and they're like, I'm going all in. I'm going all in year one. I'm making this decision. Others have done this in like a week progression every year. You know, back up your turnout date week by week until you get to where you want to be. Maybe you do that in 2 week jumps. And I've listened to all of them. I've heard the debates for and against. But at the end of the day, what do they all say? That they're happy they did it. They're happy they moved. There might have been some a learning curve. We need to, at some point, you need to ask me about matching the cow to the environment, because that's where I'm going to have to rely on you to help, you know, me muddle through some of that. But it's really important to get that we mention that as well.
Right. Well, we can go into that now if you want
Okay.
to. So yeah, kind of thinking nutritional requirements, right? So we have lactation, starting right after calving, peak lactation kind of around that 4 weeks to 6 week time frame. Okay, so then we're looking at a little bit taller new growth coming up through that dormant grasses.
And one of the biggest caveats, and the extremes are folks that have done a fire sale and completely changed their herd because they've moved to a, you know, they've made many other decisions in their operation, and this is just one of the factors that they say, you know, I have the wrong breed or the wrong structure of cows for what I want to do now. But that's kind of the extreme. The on the other end, on the more immediate end of it is managing lactation, early lactation, when you've got this highly nutritious forage now, and you got that baby that just can't quite keep up with mama, and she's happy, and she's, you know, she's eating green grass, and she's blowing her udder up, and she's milking hard, and the baby isn't quite ready, you know, to take on that volume. I'm not an expert in that. I just know that it's a concern. I know that there's ways to manage through it. If I speak more deeply to that, I'm way talking out of my arena because I just don't want to give bad advice. But I do know that it's a concern that needs to be acknowledged and it can be managed through. So
Yes.
you're our baby mama expert, you know, like you know what
So in terms of the grass we know has a ton of protein in it, right? So when green grass is growing, even that protein's going to be your highest nutrient at that point. And there's lots of data and research done in the dairy side that excess protein can have first a negative effect on reproduction. We get too high of plasma urea nitrogen levels in there. They can't utilize essentially all the protein, right? So it's coming out in the milk or the urine. So in this case, we're talking about milk on beef cattle. We're going to have the same thing. We don't necessarily see as much of a rebreed issue in beef cattle. We've kind of tried to max it out, and haven't really seen that, but we're dealing with two completely different metabolic animals, right? So one's making milk, one's making beef. But aside that, on the beef side, we talk about supplementing energy in some sort because with that protein gets broke down and needs an energy or a carbohydrate essentially to bind to be utilized. So there's a couple different things you can do. Obviously, if you have the dormant grass there, that's going to have some energy in it, so she's hopefully going to be balancing that diet. But as that green grass outgrows, I mean, just because it's got peak growth, maybe during that time, we can look at supplementing corn Sometimes it can be really hard, like you said, with access of where they're at. But cows usually like corn. And so if you get them trained to come up and eat that, that will help. Or just having some kind of a dry matter bale there. We see it in the fall when we're grazing green cover crops beside a corn stalk field. They go back and forth, or they hit the borders of the field too to kind of balance that ration. So those are some feed type things you can do. But back to the genetics of your cows, that might be something you do have to pay attention to, because milk scours, more or less, is what we would call that, right? So if you do have Sim Angus or Simmentals, Gelvies, some of those really maternal, high milking cows. Maybe the genetics of the cows, or those cows that you need to breed them so they have a little bit lower milking potential, right? Like they're
That's
meeting
yeah.
that milk potential because we're giving them all that nutrient. Like they are just, pumping it out super fast. Like you said, those calves can't always keep up. So whether
And
it's microbiome or supplements for those calves, just kind of watch and manage that. But we can make those problems in the dry lot too. So it's
yeah.
naturally better if it's coming from green grass.
Yeah, and I think, one of the most common again, you kind of eat this elephant one bite at a time. And one of the most common things that I hear that addresses that is you just simply got to be willing to cull those cows that are not going to work and fit in the new system, I don't know that I've ever really talked to anybody that, this was a problem with every animal in the herd. There's just
Probably not.
like, right. So you just got to be willing to manage the herd as a herd manager and not and make those decisions based on where you really want your herd to go. So I think if
Oh.
I oh,
I was
go
going to
ahead.
say, also on the nutrition side, I think you will see a change in body condition score by switching to this calving season as well. Again, back to, feeding for the machine. When we're calving in March, we're trying to get that body condition score caught up with those stored forages. I think when you go to May, you're going to see, yeah, that lactation requirement's hitting, but now they're able to kind of meet that lactation and maybe put on some weight at the same time. And so, depending on your genetics, like you might see some what I would call easy keeping cows really show up. I don't necessarily think we have a problem with getting too heavy conditioned because they will be having that lactation requirement in this situation. But if you have, some of those easier keeping genetics or low maintenance energy females, those are the ones that are going to hopefully really thrive and be able to raise a big calf and then keep herself in good condition too. Just when normally, if you are March calving, you're hitting that grass at peak lactation, and so there's not as she's not being able to add as much body condition score at that time. But keeping cows in good body condition score obviously is going to help with lactation, but will also help with rebreeding too. So we'll get into that in a little bit when we're moving breeding back into the heat of August, might cause another change in mindset.
Yeah, and I think you touched on this already, but I think it's worth repeating that peak body condition score versus acceptable body condition score, when you move this calving and parturition date back later in spring, you allow yourself to have less pressure to have peak body condition in the coldest months of the year, right? So that's kind of one of the key pieces of it, reducing input costs. You had mentioned we should touch on this cow size thing too, or at least calf size. So there's a couple, I think, common sense trends or truths that are really worth breaking down here a little bit in this conversation. Is one of the things that people will say, of course, it all depends on your weaning dates and when and if and how you bring your cattle to market and market your cattle. But one of the paradigms is that you're going to go to market with smaller calves. Now, that could be because you're calving later, or it could be that you've downsized your overall cow size, over time, if you've chosen to kind of do some other things that sometimes go along with more of a pasture-based system. Let's just kind of keep it simple. 15, 1600-pound cows might not be the very best match. I'm not even talking calving at this point. I'm talking about just matching to your pasture and your resources and things like that. It's also a bigger cow to maintain. But we could arguably say that that cow is going to wean a bigger calf. But one of the antithesis arguments to all this is that when you're really marketing in the fall, are you marketing calves or are you marketing pounds? And I just love this simple example. Right now, with the way prices are, now this assumes that you're going to have good performing livestock and they're going to perform well in a feed yard and all that after weaning and whatnot. But just the simple math is if you're going to market with 40 500-pound calves, you've got 20,000 pounds of beef at 500-pound average. Or you can go to market with 50 400-pound calves and still go to market with £20,000, but that's going to bring more because those 400 weights are more per pound than 500 weights. That's just how the market trends. We always know that we got a higher dollar value on the low on the lighter animal.
Your calves, yeah.
Generally, I mean, we're talking trends. Right now everything's worth a lot, so it's kind of hard to know. But going to market with the biggest calf isn't necessarily the best profit strategy. And if you've saved a bunch of money on your input costs by calving later, and you've made more money on a per pound basis, what opportunity do you have within your business to leverage that cost savings and that additional income toward business growth and management? It's just a way to think about the operation.
Free
Those
calf
that I
is
was.
worth a lot, but like you said, if you can go to calf, like keeping more smaller cows, potentially marketing more smaller calves could
Exactly.
be a good profit.
As long as you take care of your home plate and know your business and know your marketing and know your performance. But that's why I was talking about the smaller cow too, because the same philosophy is pasture carrying capacity.
True.
I can house 100 1600-pound cows, or maybe I can house 120 1200-pound cows. And if I can keep my birth weight and my weaning weights and my marketing and all that aligned, I'm probably better off with slightly smaller ca more slightly smaller calves. It also gives me, I say me, I'm saying this in third person, folks. I don't get to do this. I have to,
A couple
I
cows.
get, but but you understand the philosophy behind it. And
Right.
then, that also, I think just generally, and I'm stepping a little bit out of my comfort zone here, but I think it's not hard to wrap your head around the idea that if I have 100 cows versus 120, I have a little more freedom to make decisions with 120. I have a little more freedom to cull. I have a little more freedom to pick my replacements. I have a little more freedom to explore other marketing options just because I have more heads that to work with in the same space. And that just kind of makes business sense, so
And I think
yeah.
I have seen, like you're saying, the changes in stocking rate based on genetics. I mean, you can have a pen of Sim Angus cows beside a group of, let's say Angus animals. Those Angus are just going to be a little bit more efficient with the resources you give them. And it's just like you said, the genetics are different. The milking potential, the growth potential that you might be looking at doing might match your operation. And I kind of compare it a little bit, not exactly the same, but kind of like having stockers versus, backgrounders, right? Like you're in it for a different reason, right? You're either growing calves or you're in it for the long haul, to kind of maintain and get that frame put on. So just kind of depending on what you're looking at and doing. And we know some people that do a little bit of both. And I'll mention Charlie Totten here because I know he's a good listener of our
Yeah, he's a great
podcast,
listener. Yeah, he's a
but he's
podcast
got
junkie.
March calving and May calving,
Yep.
so you can do both. And we can, talk about infrastructure now a little bit
Yeah.
of, what do you do if you need both? Let's say you sell some bulls. So you want, those type of animals, or you want your replacement heifers to be older, so you keep those out of the March calving herd, but you also want more cows to run on, some grass that you want to calve those in May when it's easier and you have the head numbers to do it. So, what do you do if you have existing infrastructure to either do both or switch, and how do you utilize that existing
Yeah.
infrastructure?
So again, I'm not a market or financial expert, but I think that to some ways that frees me to be pretty much common sense when I talk to folks about this. And I look at this like, and I have a good friend, I can mention him. I think most listeners might that are from South Dakota are gonna be familiar with Judge Jessup. He's the coordinator of the Grassland Coalition and a good friend, and we bounce a lot of ideas off each other. And what I really appreciate, Judge, is it's so you can sit behind these desks and you can say the perfect thing, and then you get out in the world and there's a whole bunch of different realities. And so Judge and I have talked about this so much, and it's so interesting when you break down the scenarios that get you into infrastructure. Okay, so let's start with the one that is very common. We know that it's hard to get into agriculture, just right off the bat, right? So a lot of our businesses, egg businesses, cow calf enterprises, they're generational within a family, right? It's pretty rare that you don't inherit. Now, I use the word inherit pretty loosely, either purchase from the previous generation or literally inherit it. But you often get structures with that kind of a transition, right? So these things are already in existence. And so can you we can, so we have to meet people where they're at. If I purchase or inherit an operation and it's already got these structures, I probably grew up doing the use of, the business that used those structures. That's why they're there. They were probably built for that. So you got inherited structures. The second thing is you've got structures that you choose to invest in and build under the paradigm that I need calving, a place to calve. Let's keep it to calving. And then the third thing is I don't have any. I can't afford any. What do I do? Okay, so let's back up here. Let's use scenario number one. Is it wrong to continue calving in January, December anymore? It's like December through March, right? I mean, everybody's doing it. I can't say it's
Anytime.
right. Can't say it's right or wrong. I can say though that it seems like if you had to line up the things that you're fighting, that you're working with and fighting against, I would say December, January, February, you're fighting more things than you're coordinating with. Electrical bills, frozen water, vet bills, cattle management, safety, of your family, just working, all of that piles up, to say calving inside in the winter in South Dakota has a certain amount of inherent risks associated with it. Now, maybe you've mitigated those risks. That's fine. I'm not saying that they're all crises. They're just
Right.
risks, right? As you move into, say, out of that barn and into the outside or into the pasture, the risks kind of change. If you go outside in March, mud, you've already mentioned mud and snow. We know that March might be the hardest time, right? At least in January and February, it's frozen inside most of the time, but March and
Exactly.
early April is that's a tough one. That pick the weather any given day then. So the risks change and how you mitigate the risks is different. But you got this overhead, you've got this structure that you've inherited or bought with the place. That's overhead. That's something that you got to think about. So one of the interesting things that I've heard is those that have maybe chosen to go to May calving with their own cattle, might consider custom calving somebody else's cattle and using that structure. The risk is more or less than kind of handed off to the owner of the cattle. I mean, you might have a contract that says you've got some inherent responsibilities, but the risk primarily is on the owner. So you can kind of have your cake and eat it too. I'm going to calve mine outside in May and let them do the work, but I got free time in January. Maybe I'll custom calve somebody else that has made a different decision with how they're managing their herd.
Yeah, that's
So
a
that's
good
kind
way,
of.
like you said, for new people to get in a little bit. They whether they're young or just beginning farmers, right? Labor is their number one asset that they can offer somebody, and they're young and they maybe don't need as much sleep as you and I. And so, they can provide that labor to calve cows if they have that small facility.
Can be
I
a
know
great income
several
stream.
guys that do that. Yeah, yep. And they keep them for a week or two and then send live calves back, and it works great for both parties.
Yeah, especially like on replacement heifers, right? Or something that's like a niche
Yes.
that you just maybe there's only maybe they only need 50 of the 500 calved somewhere that they just know that there's eyes on them, right? And if
Right.
you mentioned earlier before the podcast, you got all this technology, cameras and all these things that you can invest in and okay, so then there's a second scenario where now I'm going to invest and I'm going to build a calving barn. All of those same arguments apply, but are you going to, get the maximum return out of a structure that is more or less designated for one operation? I recently spoke with a coworker that's trying to get a calving barn built. And what would be the other 9 months of the year use of the structure? Something to think about. Is it does it return? Does it only return for 1 or 2 months of the year, or does it return to the operation for 12 months? Something to think about, and
I would
then.
say too that as we get into summer, maybe fall calvers could go in there for a little bit of shade, but not necessarily everyone has that now. But I think a lot of people are kind of adding that other one. But yeah, like you said, it only pays for itself maybe a month out of the year to save those live calves, and then you probably park equipment in it.
And then I really wonder too, like if anybody really put pen to paper. I've always wondered this. I don't have an answer, Taylor, but when you talk about your true cost, we talked about this at the calving camp, and there's a lot of just assumed inherent overhead that we don't even, electricity, water, labor, lack of sleep, vet bills, I mean, does it make sense to make $50 or $100 more on a calf at the barn if you've invested $50 into medicine on the front end to keep it alive in the spring or in the early, in the winter, let's say. And I know that's a little bit of an extreme. I'm kind of reaching for extremes there, but I just think that initial investment is always there, when you're working that hard for the cow, So I go back to the Hayman example, the Breck Hayman example, out of Clear Lake. I love Breck's example here. He just looks at it really practically. He got to the point where he needed to calve out more animals, opportunity, whatever came about that he had additional. And he got to the point where he's like, where am I going to calve and how am I going to calve? And for him, he just looked at the math and said, why should I build a barn that's going to require equity that I could invest into my herd? And so he made the decision to secure more land and more livestock and let the cattle do the work. And he never looked back. Never built that thing that wasn't going to pay him back nearly as much as more calves on the ground in May have paid him back. I think it's just a simple, it's a kind of, it's just a simple business decision. And then the freedom, again, this is getting to the point where you really are managing the cattle and the grass more than the structures and stuff. But once he made that decision, they don't even necessarily calve it on the same pasture every year at all. They're so far into this, they're just so comfortable with it. So he's like, I can manage my grasslands. I can manage my business with my cows because they're not tied to a structure that's on this particular piece of land. I can achieve land management goals and objectives while also calving, you know, stacked
Well,
enterprises in a different
yeah,
way.
let's go down a little bit of the crop side of that. And I'm
Okay.
going to get this crop livestock integration. We should probably
Yeah.
pull another coworker into.
Yeah.
But what about calving on like rye? Okay, let's say you don't have that calving pasture quite ready yet or
Yeah.
something. What about calving on those type of things?
So now we're getting into the realm of Superfund speculation, but why not, right? Let's ask it that way. Like, if you've already gotten to the point where you're comfortable calving outside and you're comfortable calving in the months that it's a little easier, now you're talking about animal and nutrition management questions more so than you are practical, structural or labor questions. If you're calving outside, why does it matter where you calve outside? And if you're calving in
Right.
May, why is so what why it matters is again is those other factors, those other resources. Is rye, I can't say for sure if rye is a good idea. I don't know if it's I doubt that it's got anything that would make it a bad idea, other than maybe you'd have to balance it. It's probably a pretty hot forage in May, you know, when it's 30 inches high. But I do have to mention, I think it's really worth mentioning this particular point. Airflow is always essential, right? We know that in barns and we know that in grass. If you don't have airflow, you can be, you know, so a dense rye stand and a cold May day might be fantastic. A dense rye stand and a hot, stagnant May day, when it's, you know, near in 90 or maybe more degrees, without airflow, without air movement, that can be hard on a calf too. So, you know, we have to offer I mean it
Still can't
sounds
get rid of all of
so
your protection, right? Like
yeah,
we kind of started talking about that. You still got to have wind protection. You still might have to have a roof or something because cold
well,
rain,
when I say
gets
protection,
those.
I mean natural protections, but I mean what it really comes back to is it's those that know and have heard are diversity and heterogeneity are the two words that really come to, like, you want that cow and that calf to have options out there on the landscape. You want them to have bright, you know, the open sunny area when it is needed. You want to be able to tuck in behind a tuft of grass or a rock or a shrub when it's needed, you know. And by and large, you know, you don't need the roof necessarily, but we do live in a world of extremes in South Dakota. And I mean, I'll be honest, if they were mine and it was sleeting and freezing, I would want them to probably to, I might want to chase them in that day, you know. But I will say that, you know, animals are tough, and those that do it more than I ever have really learned to manage through it, you know. The other thing that I think, again, I'm going out on a bit of a limb here because I don't ever intend to tell anyone their business. If you've saved so much on your input cost and you've maximized your return potential on the back end, I'm gonna pose this question. And if you look at it from a business model, can you stand just a little bit of death loss? Right? You don't want to, but is that death loss of 2 or 3 per hundred, let's say, I don't know, you know, I'm just picking numbers. If you've managed all your inputs, that death loss is a little easier to take than it is if you've got high inputs and then you lose them, right? So
Yeah, maybe you
I think
change
that's
it from 2% to 3%.
right.
What does that look like? Right.
And it all
Kind of
has to be
getting.
weighed back against your, you know, what your inputs are. And if you've kept your inputs really, really low, you can, you know, you can weather that storm a little better.
If we look at, let's go to breeding
True.
quick. Look at breeding. And so we started off talking about, turning out bulls, right? So, bulls are usually pushing the fence lines when that green grass starts coming and seems to be the urge to not turn them out. I heard someone recently compare it to transitioning away from tillage. You just can't. Just don't do it. Just don't hook up your, drill, right? You go to no-till that way. So what do you do with those bulls for an extra 2 months? of the year, right? But my argument to that is, they can also be on green grass for 2 months earlier doing, I mean, not say nothing, but preparing to do their job too. So as we transition that calving season back, those cows are going to have, let's say in your first year, you're going to have a longer postpartum interval, right? So that's, possibly going to change your, we know it's going to change your marketing plan the next year, but that should be a positive change to your reproductive efficiency. So they're going to have several cycles before that bull hits them. That bull's going to have plenty of time to prepare himself. So also on the economic side, you could see a boost in that calving percentage in the first 30 days of your breeding season with more cows getting bred, and also leaving you to change the length of your calving season then. So you can put selection pressure on your breeding season, and so you're hopefully going to have a return in the long run that could be positive as well. And you can do this at any time of year, but I'm just saying in that first year, you might see that really big boost because of that longer postpartum interval.
Well, and I, again, this is outside of my what I feel like I've really I just got to stay in my lane here a little bit, but it all makes so much sense. Just everything you just said, it just makes sense. And if you think it doesn't make sense, nobody questions fall calving anymore. I mean, that you sure aren't turning bulls out in June and getting calves in September. So like people do know how to manage bulls, right? And I just go back to the kind of cowboy logic, it's pretty easy not to open the gate. Like that's the, and I think I hear that all the time from those that are trying to explain how this works. It's so fascinating being third party to these conversations a lot of time, 'cause that's where I pick up most of my knowledge is just listening. And I wouldn't call it my knowledge. It's just regurgitating what others have taught me. But yeah, it's a fun conversation to listen to two people battle out over, well, how do you manage your bulls? And it's just like, finally, it's like, well, I just don't open the gate. I just, just instead of opening the gate, I go to town or I go to do
Right.
something
Yep.
else. Like
Feed
take
them
away the pre,
and
actually go to the 4th of July parade instead of turning bulls out that day or something like that,
You have the guys that say, I come home and I turn them out on the 5th of July, right? Like that's, or maybe it is the morning of the 4th of July, but yeah, making, good fences. But I mean, those bulls are like gonna get them on grass. They're gonna do way better, and they're sperm development, I guess, starts 60 days before the breeding season of what's actually servicing those cows. And so, I mean, they're making that while they're eating that green grass too. That's got to be better for them. It's so hard to test bulls in the winter, right? They're stale, like they're not given a great sample, right? As we get into spring, it just gets easier and easier. So, they're following what Mother Nature is telling them to do too. And like I said, your service rate should be pretty good, and allows you to have that selection pressure on fertility of maybe you do only want to keep those cows that breed in the first 30 days. They're then more likely to breed early every year after that. And so keeping that 30-day breeding season, maybe is a great transition as well at the same time. So then you're done calving and 30 days is pretty extreme, but even if you're going from 90 down to 60 days, you're still done by the 4th of July then. So it's a good thought to maybe do both at the same time if you're looking to, put some pressure on fertility.
Well, I know that there's people out there listening to this and probably telling themselves, wow, I wish I was giving this podcast because I do this all, every day. And there's so many that I would call true experts in this, and they think rationally about these decisions and they think strategically, and they, I guess I'm going to back up. They think, they just, they spend time thinking and breaking it down and not overwhelming themselves with every little nuance. They take it piece by piece and say, okay, well, if I'm going to make this decision, then how does it affect this decision? And kind of just to what you said, if you want to tighten up your breeding season or your calving season, now you've got, let's just make this kind of general assumption. Maybe you've gone to smaller cows, or maybe you've done some of those decisions. again, you have more to choose from to make those decisions, and you can tighten up that herd and tighten up those performance objectives within time frames a little easier because you have more to choose from. You know, that's kind of a generalization, but it does make sense. You know, like that you kind of buffer risk with more opportunity, maybe, you know, is the best way to say it.
Yeah,
As
you're
we're
kind of killing two birds with one stone a little bit of taking a little bit of the risk out of calving. And then you're also maybe taking the risk out of those late calvers, changing your calving season.
Yeah, this is so fun. There's just so many different nuances. I don't know if I've got any. Oh, one of the other things that, okay, so this is just a little bit of a tangent, but it's a super fun to share. We mentioned about just generally mimicking nature, right? And we know that we're dealing with a domestic animal that's been bred and manipulated, and I mean, we've got all the breeds and we've got all their performance objectives and all that stuff. But bottom line is they're still a more or less natural animal. And I can't cite this scientifically just because I don't have it in front of me, but I can vouch that it's true that there's many cases where there's been like open breeding, you know, just a herd functioning as a herd, bulls loose year round. Greg Judy is one good example of this down in Missouri. That over about the course of a couple years, the whole herd basically lands on a natural calving cycle, similar to elk and bison and deer, you know, where they basically the majority of the calves fall hit the ground in May. Even just, you know, so these animals are probably predisposed to some degree. You know, I'm not going to go too far here, but I don't think it's too hard of a stretch to understand that these animals are predisposed to kind of know biologically, inherently, you know, genetically what works with the natural cycles of time and space in the year, you know, if that makes sense.
And I've heard it, said maybe another way of if you're, maybe, like you said, different subject, but looking at maybe not putting all your labor into getting cows bred early and then pulling the bulls and then preg checking and culling cows. Like obviously cull cows are a very important piece of people's cash flow, but if you dedicate yourself to, managing your herd, they'll probably fit into that window eventually if you don't nurture them into one way or another. So
And there's an
that is another way to look
associated,
at it.
yeah, and then there's associated trend, and this really gets beyond what I can't comment more than what I'm going to say, but there's an associated trend with all this toward improved longevity of the cow in the herd. Whereas the national average is, you know, if you look at ranching for profit, I think they cite the national average as being about four calves per cow on average in her lifespan or her contribution. To me, I've always just been like, really? Only four calves? I think that this trends toward a longer lifespan of a cow, of the cow in the herd, just generally speaking. I'm going to leave it at that. And you can listen to our experts more on that. And we'll talk about that at the end of the podcast here as to how to find out more on this. Okay, so one of the other things that I had on my list of topics is predators and predation on calving. I as a biologist, as a big game biologist, and you know, by training and practice and all these things, I have to tread lightly on this subject because you know, mostly what we're talking about is coyotes in South Dakota and the belief that coyotes can be quite, you know, detrimental to calves. And I'm not gonna ever tell anybody that they don't know what's going on their own ranch. If they you know, who am I to say whether you've observed coyotes killing your calves or not? But generally speaking, what we think is a coyote kill oftentimes is a dead calf that's getting eaten by coyotes, more or less. Now, that doesn't, not defending the coyote population or anything like that. I'm just using coyotes as a really good example here. So one of the concerns is like, geez, if I'm putting baby calves on the ground out in, on pasture, am I just inviting a predator problem for myself? And by and large, the answer is no. And the reason the answer is oftentimes, more often than not, no, quite often no. In fact, I would say that it's rare that it's yes that you're feeding coyotes, is that at that time of year, yeah, your cattle are dropping their babies, but guess what? So is everything else. We just, we already established that. All the fawns and nests and everything's on the ground at that time, right? So predators have a quite a smorgasbord in front of them. They're not going to choose the hardest thing to eat, and it's pretty hard to eat a calf when mama's chasing you off. They're going to go for the easy meal. Now that doesn't, none of this is 100% all the time, but let's just talk about, shooting for the middle here. Predation isn't really a large concern for most anyone that makes this choice. And you got to remember too that the afterbirths and things like that are out there on the land now. That's the easier meal than going for the calf. And I'm not saying that it can't or won't happen. I'm just saying that generally speaking, we have to kind of keep these things within the realm of perception and reality. The perception is that we're maybe going to have a bunch of dead babies because of predation. The reality is it just doesn't happen all that much or to any great extent. That doesn't mean that there's not the one-off where you get a pair of coyotes or a mama coyote that really gets to like calves. It can happen. I mean, I think we'd be silly to say that it can't, but generally speaking, this isn't such a huge issue. I thought it would just be important to frame that a little bit.
Yeah, that's something I
You know.
definitely don't think about. I mean, like you said, it happens. And sometimes we often think it's because of maybe a poor mama or we just quit checking cows or quit worrying about it, right? And then it just happens all of a sudden. But there's way to manage around that as well. Like you said, for technology purposes, I think there's people that like to scout those type of things, and maybe there's a way to figure out how to pick your calving pasture that's not in, a high traffic area.
Well,
I
and
don't
even
really
if it,
know.
and I think really even if it is, I think that's what we're trying to say is that those are tough paradigms to switch. But if you
Don't
think
worry
about it,
about it.
really, how many animals do you really? Now, that doesn't mean a coyote won't eat a dead calf, and that's oftentimes where the perception comes in, is like, oh geez, that coyote killed it. Well, did it really kill it, or did that calf die and that coyote's just cleaning up? And I'm not at all wanting to create a debate about whether we should or shouldn't control coyotes. I mean, there's a million different views on all of that, but just specifically for this issue, coyote predation really shouldn't be the deterrent for making a move if all your other business decisions point you toward making this move. I guess that's what I really want to say.
Okay. Yep. All right. Well, I think we're nearing the end of the notes or questions I had. What else do you
Yeah.
have, Pete?
I really don't have anything else. I think that this it's a I think this is, again, we're just kind of opening the door here, right? But I said at the beginning, I'm not an expert. If you really want to hear the experts who have done this talk about it, we were blessed to have recorded a bunch of ranchers that have made these decisions a few years back with the South Dakota Grassland Coalition. And
Okay,
so
perfect.
if a listener logs on to sdgrass.org, or just type in South Dakota Grassland Coalition, or you'll find it easy enough. If you've never been to the Grassland Coalition's website, just type in grass South Dakota, sdgrass.org, you'll get there. And under the resources tab, there's a little drop-down menu, and about three things down, it's called calving considerations video. And there is no less than, I think, at least 15 or 20, at least 15. I mean, we've got ranchers across the state, in all corners of the state, from the northeast to the southwest and everywhere in between,
Okay.
that break this down just wonderfully and in through interviews. And we ask some pretty hard questions, and we just let them talk and explain their operations. And you'll hear from some that have gone all in immediately, some that wish they would have maybe done it differently, some that wish they would have done it more aggressively, some that have decided to run a dualistic kind of operation where they're calving on pasture in May as far as part of their business, and they may be taking advantage of their infrastructure in another part of their business. So all we've done here is open the door, right? Open the gate, I guess you might say. I really encourage people to listen to these folks because they're the ones that live it. And I could never be convincing enough. And I'm not necessarily trying to sell it. I'm just saying that if you really want to hear how and why it works, log on to the Grassland Coalition website and listen to these testimonials. And they're all
Right.
about, anywhere from 6 to 12 minutes or so. So it's easy listening.
Right. So if you're thinking about doing it, you have lots of resources to make calls, ask questions. I know lots of those guys are an open book, more or less, right? Like their phone numbers are available on some mentor pages, I think, on the South Dakota Grass Coalition too, of, if you have a question on calving season, if you have a question on establishing grass, maybe it is doing that dual purpose enterprise with your infrastructure. You should be asking those questions long before you get into trying it yourself. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. And like Pete said, we're just asking the questions. We're just scratching the surface of this. It might work best for you to stay calving in January or March, or start fall calving. So we recognize that there's lots of ways to do that, and we all want to eat beef year round, and so we want to make sure it's available. And we get more calves on the ground is kind of the story behind this of, if there's a way to do that, this might be one of those ways. But we can encourage you guys to give us comments, questions. And you can find both of our contact informations on the extension website, which is extension.sdstate.edu. This Cattle HQ podcast links and scripts are available there if you would rather read it, or you can listen to it, obviously, on whatever podcast thing you're listening to. So, any last comments from you, Pete?
I just wanted to say thanks. I think this is super fun to get to have an opportunity to share some of this and out with our producers. I also wanted to mention you mentioned the mentoring network. So on the Grassland Coalition, on that same drop down list, there is the mentoring network, and it's by category. This isn't necessary. They're redoing this right now, so it's a little out of date. But if you scroll down, you'll see several different herd management. I mean, pick a topic and it kind of overlaps, but all the way down toward the bottom, after about 20 or so topics, the second to the last is calving in sync with nature. And it's got some mentors listed there as well.
Okay, that sounds
So
good. So, if you are wanting to get Pete out of the office, since he said he would love to have his office in the pickup, give him a call to come check out your calving pastures too. We will be happy to help answer any questions you have. So, once again, this has been Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef cattle. Visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information. And until our next episode, eat beef.
thank you for tuning in to this episode of Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef. We invite you to visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information, as well as subscribe to the show on Spotify. You will also find show notes and resources from today's episode. Until next time, remember, success is not a goal, it's a byproduct.